The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Well, now, Sir Keir Starmer's decision to appoint Peter Mandelson as UK ambassador to the US continues to be perhaps the most consequential decision of his premiership so far. Sky News is reporting this morning at least two senior civil servants knew weeks ago that Mandelson had failed security vetting for that job as US ambassador. But they didn't pass the information over to the Prime Minister until Tuesday of this week. Why? Because they were waiting for legal checks on what information could actually be released. Starmer and the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper sacked the foreign boss, his name is Sir Ollie Robbins, on Thursday over the decision to grant Mandelson security clearance anyway, despite a vetting failure. Starmer is going to face MPs tomorrow as he returns to Parliament, while Robbins will appear before the Foreign Affairs Committee of MPs on Thursday. Now, talking about all of this and how long Sir Keir Starmer can stick it out, I suppose, Financial Times political editor George Parker. George, good morning and welcome.
Morning.
This is another fine mess Sir Keir Starmer has got himself into. My first reaction to all of this is that when you're explaining, you're losing.
I think that's a fair way of putting it. Look, it's a slow motion disaster for Keir Starmer, the whole Peter Mandelson appointment. As Peter Mandelson was appointed back in December 2024, or announced anyway, and since then it's been an absolute shambles from beginning to end. And ironically for Keir Starmer, and this doesn't reflect well on him at all, I should say, he was never that close to Peter Mandelson. This idea of sending Mandelson to Washington to add a bit of political heft to our operation there to deal with Donald Trump came from Cork man Morgan McSweeney, who was a Mandelson protege and pushed very hard for Mandelson to be sent. And rather than sort of saying, well, hang on a sec, Mandelson's a serial scandal waiting to happen, basically Keir Starmer said, fine, you get on with it, and washed his hands of the whole thing. And as you say, it's become probably the most consequential appointment of his time as Prime Minister.
Now, what were the positives in the recommendation to send Mandelson over to Washington? I mean, what skills was he thought to have that would have suited him to the Trump administration?
Yeah, so Peter Mandelson was one of the architects of Tony Blair's election victory back in 1997, so he's woven himself into Labour folklore for that. He was seen as an indispensable advisor by Tony Blair. And then later, despite sort of a certain amount of animosity with Gordon Brown brought him back from Brussels, where he's serving as a British European Commissioner, to try to rescue his floundering premiership at the end of the 2000s. So Keir Starmer is the third Labour Prime Minister to turn to Peter Mandelson for advice. And he was thought to be someone who had experience of the business world. He's someone with international experience and someone with extreme political talents, and therefore ideally suited for dealing with the minefield of the Donald Trump administration. But famously, Peter Mandelson's very good at dispensing advice to others, but totally incapable of taking advice himself or seeing what trouble he himself is getting himself into.
I mean, I remember when he was appointed as Northern Ireland Secretary and people were wondering how he would adapt to the role. He was already known as the Prince of Darkness, and whether or not he could make friends on both sides of the sectarian divide, if you like, and get talking to them. Can you recall how did he get on? It was short enough lived, I suppose.
Yeah, it was a short-lived appointment, but I think he was quite widely highly regarded across the divide in Northern Ireland. Look, he's someone who sort of is professional, and actually, having sort of covered him for many years, it's quite instructive that officials working for him are always very positive about him. They think someone who gets across his brief, takes the job seriously, and most importantly, if you're an official working for him, is someone who carries clout at the very highest level, and that would have applied when he was Northern Ireland Secretary as well. So he was admired within the system.
Now, can you remind us of the previous scandals before the Epstein one that he was caught up in?
Yeah, so he had to resign twice from the government. The first occasion was he accepted a loan to buy a posh house from a Labour minister who his own department, the Department of Business, was investigating for business irregularities, and he hadn't told anyone. So that was a bit of a fail, as they might say. The second one was over allegations that he used excessive influence to gain a British passport for an Indian businessman, one of the Hinduja brothers. To be fair to Peter Mandelson, he was subsequently cleared for that. But the problem was he was unable to explain what had gone on very clearly, and he had the rug pulled out of him very quickly. He was sent off to Brussels. He seemed to have done quite a good job, actually, to be fair, in Brussels. But all the while, his fatal weakness is his attraction to money and his attraction in particular to wealthy men and wealthy individuals.
Now, when you move in those circles, if you're to be effective, you I suppose, have to be comfortable, not to be overawed by the wealth of whether it's the tech bros or Trump's billionaire buddies or even his buddies in cabinet who are, you know, incredibly wealthy. You've got to feel comfortable when you're moving in those circles. And I presume that's where Mandelson scored.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Mandelson is attracted to wealth, as I mentioned, but wealthy people are attracted to Peter Mandelson because he's someone who just exudes influence and power and gossip as well. Peter Mandelson is an inveterate gossip. You could spend a very enjoyable hour with him, sort of with him dispensing all sorts of gossip about cabinet colleagues and stuff. So he's someone who the wealthy feel comfortable with because they think he gives them an insight into the world of power. And he, as I said, loves being surrounded by wealthy people.
And also there's that business of wealthy people don't usually welch on each other. You know, they keep their counsel close, and if they know something about their buddies, they're not going to splash it to a tabloid. And I presume they thought they could trust Mandelson.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. They felt he was quite discreet, and Peter Mandelson obviously believed his own hype because he thought he could basically keep his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein on the down low as well.
Now, you know, his demise was slow in coming, but I suppose the ultimate release of that picture of Peter Mandelson in his underwear in one of Epstein's apartments, was it in Paris? That was his final undoing. But this probably would have come out in any event, given the scale of the Epstein scandals. So where did the Prime Minister fall down, if indeed it was the Prime Minister who did fall down, or his officials, and particularly Ollie Robinson, who got the chop?
Yes, well, look, I mean, as I said at the start, Peter Mandelson was attracted to Morgan Rousseau was attracted to the idea of sending Mandelson there. Mandelson basically said to Ollie Robinson, look, if you think you can get around all the problems that's come with Peter Mandelson, you get on and do it. Basically, Morgan McSweeney did went through some early vetting checks. They said there were problems with Jeffrey Epstein. Mandelson said it's all in the past, it's all fine. Morgan McSweeney believed him. Then there was a separate vetting operation, which was overseen by Ollie Robbins, you just mentioned there, who was the former, now the former head of the Foreign Office. And this is the most intrusive and personal level of vetting, where you're asked about your sexual preferences, your financial affairs, and so forth. Now, the interesting thing about that is that Mandelson had already been announced as the ambassador at the end of December. He'd been given access to confidential documents at the beginning of January, and the vetting came after all of that. So by the time this landed on Ollie Robbins' desk, that he'd failed the vetting, Ollie Robbins was placed in a very difficult position because he knew that Number 10 wanted Mandelson to go to Washington. He had this dynamite information on his desk. And rather than, basically, he did what good civil servants do typically. They respond to the political signals being sent from the top and gave Keir Starmer what they thought he wanted. But as it turned out, now this is all out in the open, it's an absolutely terrible decision and left everyone looking terrible.
Now, the excuse that we couldn't tell the PM anything until we got legal clearance as to what could be disclosed, because if you, as you say, this is an incredibly intrusive vetting process into the very innards of someone's private life. How many people have the right to know? I mean, you might argue, how much do the security services have the right to know? But in terms of the security of the state, it's probably important that they know everything that might come back to bite them. But, you know, can you share with even the highest elected official, the Prime Minister, stuff that really maybe he should not have eyes on?
Well, the law said, and this is the legal position that Ollie Robbins was hiding behind, really, was that the final decision on whether to approve vetting or not was not for politicians or ministers. It was for the head of the department, the head official. That was him. And so what he says he did was he read the vetting report. He assumed that Keir Starmer already knew about the Jeffrey Epstein things. That was well known publicly, and that he already knew about the Chinese business connections that Peter Mandelson had. And so what he did was he said, right, we're going to put in some mitigations, in inverted commas, which basically he said that Mandelson wouldn't be able to speak to his old business clients without someone else being in the room. And then he basically said, with all that said and done, pass on the message to Number 10, it's all fine. And that was basically the government's position until last week when it turned out that, of course, everything wasn't fine and that a big red box had been ticked by the betting officer saying, don't give this person security betting. So you end up in a situation where one of the most senior people in the British government, the ambassador to Washington, has been sent to Washington, deemed a security risk, and the Prime Minister doesn't know. It's an absolute, well, dog's breakfast, to put it mildly.
Absolutely, it's an incredible situation. But then you had, if he had been told, and he's going to say, no, I didn't learn about all of this, that there was a red flag until last week. But if he had known, and he was told subsequent to the announcement, but before the deployment, if you like, what was he supposed to do? Go sack him publicly, having just appointed him?
Well, that's exactly what a government minister said this morning on the BBC. Liz Kendall said that had he known that Mandelson had failed the vetting test, he would not have been made ambassador. So this was the problem, the dilemma that Ollie Robbins faced, that he knew Mandelson, that Number 10 and Starmer wanted Mandelson to go to Washington. And he also knew that if he flagged this up, it would be a massive political reverse for Starmer and a huge embarrassment. Because, you know, he'd been announced the ambassador, he'd been given privileged documents already, for that to be reversed. So basically what happened was the man from Whitehall hid behind all the normal sort of Whitehall rules and verbiage and basically said, well, we've done all this stuff, everything's fine. And the normal vetting procedures have been followed was the formula they used to try to explain what happened. And all that would have stayed in the undergrowth had it not been for the fact that Mandelson, of course, was sacked last year as ambassador, and then Parliament demanded to see every single document that related to Mandelson's appointment. So all the stuff that would normally be in the innards of Whitehall was suddenly out in the public domain, and it looks really awful.
So in summary then, George, how much trouble is Starmer in? Will he weather this particular storm?
Well, there are some really difficult elections coming up for Labour in 3 weeks' time. That's going to put the skids under Keir Starmer further. My assessment is that Labour MPs, although it's very hard to find anyone who thinks that Keir Starmer is going to lead Labour into the next election, are going to hold their nerve for now. Let Keir Starmer own the electoral disaster that will unfold on May the 7th. And then, of course, people will move on to, well, when? How long is it going to be? And you know, my assessment talking to Labour MPs that most of them measure his time in Downing Street now more in months rather than in years.
George Parker, Financial Times political editor. George, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
At Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.